The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
Very good. It's nice to be back. I've been gone for a while now again. I went to visit my mom and dad in Finland. Met some Buddhist groups in Finland as well, so it was quite nice. I was there for 3 weeks, and then I was a week in Singapore, been traveling around, and also there's been a. We have so many other monks now who are teaching now here, and nuns, of course. So it's very, very nice. You get to hear all the other teachers. We don't have the same teachers all the time. So I think it's a high blessing. It's a very. We're very fortunate. I've been going to places, and like in Finland, I'm seen to be the one of the only monks. We don't really have other monks there. We have a. There's another monk actually. He's quite a bit more senior to me. He actually ordained. Some of you know Chikun Sunim, and this Finnish monk ordained actually with the same place that Chikun Sunim. There, where he went to the same monastery. So he's in a Korean tradition, but. He's a Finnish monk, and he lives in Italy, and I'm a Finnish monk, and I live in Australia. There's two of us. There's apparently a third one in Thailand. I have no recollection, but another interesting thing, we have a connection. Ajahn Sadaro comes from the same monastery, so he's in Ajahn Sadaro's monastery, but apparently he's a very quiet monk, and so he's there just at Ajahn Anand's monastery. So there's three of us. So we are far apart, and there's very few of us, so... So it was quite nice. It's nice to see people, no matter where you go, people are the same, and we all have the same, very, very similar mind states, and we all have this quest to find a meaning and happiness in life. Finland was voted, I think it's fifth or sixth time in a row, if we were voted the happiest country in the world, and... I went there, and it didn't seem to be extremely happy there either. Very, very similar to Australia or Singapore. I didn't see a big difference there in the happiness of the people. They'd done some research, and I thought it was interesting. I actually gave a talk in Singapore about happiness, and I was thinking about a little bit what makes Finland happy, and I read about it, and they interviewed this one sociologist, a professor on it, and he said that society is very even in Nordic countries, and that seems to be, it elevates the people's happiness when we don't have this big discrepancy between the poor and the rich. So paying taxes seems to make people happy. It's interesting, because taxes are actually something which evens out the society really well. So I think in Australia we should pay even more taxes. Have less private schools, have more like all state schools. We all go in the same schools and all that. And I think there's something to that. I firmly believe, obviously I'm come from, we call it the socialistic country, and I've grew up with that. I reap the benefits, and you have a lot of opportunities. You're not limited by certain socioeconomic factors, because you can all come from different, you know, works of life, and you can end up in being a boss of Nokia in Finland or anything. As a matter of fact, actually, one of my ex-girlfriend's father was one of the big bosses in Nokia. I was lost. Anyways, I'm glad I lost that, because I could become a monk. Who knows where I would be now. Embarrassing revelations. Sometimes you tell people these things. Anyhow, yesterday we had a really good meditation day, and I was just thinking the same thing I was teaching in Finland. I went to Finland and Singapore, and you give these talks, but a lot of people are interested in meditation and mindfulness. It seems to be a big thing here, and I walked in here in Hall, and there was a big sign here, "You mindful parking." So we have all kind of mindfulness these days. Mindful parking and mindful... What else mindfulness? We can have many types of mindfulness. And actually, one group asked me, I was in Finland, and they were quite specific that they didn't want me to talk about too much about Buddhism. there's a bit of a connotation of when you say Buddhism, we are religion. And it certainly serves as a purpose for religion for some of us. But mindfulness and meditation is really, it's helping a lot of people, and it seems to be a lot of people can relate to this practice. And I think it's an unappreciated fact that it brings out a certain kind of happiness in our mind when we take this practice of contemplation. Yesterday we had the one-day meditation here, and it was Simon actually who was organizing the teachings. Very nicely he put that the topic was Buddhanusati and Dhammanusati. Anusati is a really nice topic, and it really uplifted my mind when I saw that. It's like, yeah, that's a really, let's do that. I thought it was a great idea. This recollection, anusati means recollection, something you put in your mind over and over again. Ajahn Brahm likes to say it sometimes that these days he sees it almost like looking from a different angle. Like you look at it from different angles, you're looking at it differently, you see something differently. And I like that idea that quite often I think we've been traditionally, you go many Buddhist centers and we just chanted the Buddha, Dhamma, Sanghanusati, and we always, recollect in those terms. There's a very almost specific way. This is how we do in Theravada Buddhist circles. These are the recollections we do. But if you think about it, recollection, it's if that uplifts your mind, you grew up with that and you put effort and it reminds yourself, you know, of course, then it's good. But if you don't have that cultural thing what uplifts your mind, you might have to look at differently or, you know, uplift your mind somehow, some other way. I know, like the tradition I come from, the Thai forest tradition, very often the Thai masters, the teachers, they always said the breathing meditation, they instructed a lot of people who have this butto, butto, butto. So you're breathing in but and you're breathing out to, but to. So you sort of combine these two things together. And I think why it really works well, and I've discussed this with Ajahn Brahm early on, why does it really work? Like, why do they teach? And that people have a lot of faith in the Buddha. It's such an integral part of that society. And I know definitely in parts of the Northeast where it's almost like it's a very, very faith-based society. There's a lot of faith, a lot of sweetness in people, and they have a lot of faith in the Buddha and Dhamma and Sangha. When you do that, it uplifts your mind. It's something interesting. You grew up with that. But if for me, for example, if I would have just combined that mantra of Buddha with breathing, it doesn't have that feeling impact. It doesn't have that impact for me because I didn't grow up with that. I come from Northern Finland. There's no Buddhism there. I don't have this kind of cultural uplifting factors on my mind. So for me, I had to develop the anusati, that kind of thing differently. And, you know, you have to find your own way, what uplifts your mind. There's actually six kinds of anusatis, there's six kinds of recollections or contemplations, what the Buddha actually recommended, or that's what he said, there's these kind of six recollections. So we have the Buddha, recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. So we have those three. Yesterday we did Buddha and Dhamma. They're quite nice. From us, we bow down quite often. I do myself as well. Every time I sit down somewhere here in a seat, or I go there on the Dhana Sala, I sit down, I bow down to the Buddha if there's a Buddha statue. And I always really try to put the effort in bringing in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And it really, it brings a beautiful qualities in your mind when you keep doing it over and over again. And you, because you refine this thing. And in Buddha said, it's like refining gold, like a goldsmith. When you're heating up the gold and you're refining the gold, when you recollect these things. But then we have the other three, which are not thought so often. So we have, I'm not sure that any, the order doesn't matter so much, but so we have the three others, Anchaganusati, then we have Silanusati, and the last one, the sixth one is Devanusati. Sorry, I'm using the Pali language, but, you know, I'm just used to using that, and it's easier for me to remember them in these kind of sequences. Quite often in Pali we have these, or in the suttas we have, everything goes in, you know, numbered, or they go in sequences, all that. So the three others, jaga, what is jaga? Anybody? Generosity, yeah, that's perfect. And it also could mean relinquishing. It also could mean this kind of giving up. Jaga is almost, it's not just generosity in a sense that you give dana. It's many other things as well, but it is really a big part of that. So sila nusati, then it's that easier. Sila, you would say, what would be sila? What would be a good translation for sila? Sila would be, morality, yeah, virtue, morality. I like Ajahn Brahmali these days like to translate it as kindness, and I like that. And it has a good foundation where it comes from as well, like to sila, goodness of your heart. Because at the time of the Buddha, there's one story where this one monk comes to the Buddha and says, "Look, we have." I think at that time he said, we have 150 rules. Now we have 227. So all the rules didn't exist yet at the time when this monk went to talk to the Buddha. And he said, look, I can't remember 150 rules. And the Buddha said, can you just remember two things? Don't do anything which hurt yourself or hurt others. Just those two things you have to remember, nothing else. If it hurts you, don't do it. And if it hurts others, don't do it either. And he said, can you remember those things, two things? And he said, yes, I can remember that. Okay, don't worry about the other rules then. They all combine. If you combine all the rules, whether it's monks' rules or your, you know, the five precepts you follow, if it hurts you, don't do it. If you think a little bit of lying doesn't hurt, a little bit of killing or drinking alcohol, it doesn't hurt you, well, then you can do it. So, but in that sense, you contemplate what makes you a kinder person, and then the happiness comes from that. So all of this anusati, this contemplation, these things, I like to think them as something which uplifts your mind. So that's why we can do them. We don't have to be so specific that the Buddha said these are the exactly once we should be contemplating. Perhaps the Buddha doesn't bring you that beautiful feeling of uplifting your mind because you didn't grow up with that culture. It's not there yet. And it, later on, when you keep at it, it does start bringing you that idea like, wow, that's amazing. That's kind of like it's so inspiring. The inspiration, it's not there yet in the beginning, but when you keep at it, the inspiration comes. Same with the Dhamma or Sangha. But with the jaga and sila, with the generosity and sila, goodness or morality or virtue, those are really nice things to contemplate. I'm a moral person. I'm a good person. I have goodness in my heart. It's always very easy to go into the leaning to the side of like, well, I'm nothing special, or remember the things you should not have done, all those things. It's very, very easy to lean towards that. But so you need to cultivate these things. You need to look at them from different angles. You need to refine the gold inside of you. And that uplifts your mind and it inspires you. And then all of these things should lead you into way of having a clarity of mind, having a mind which is more at ease. And then that helps you with meditation, that helps you with everyday life, that helps you with just happiness. So think of those things that I should be doing these things. I should put more effort into just thinking about my own goodness. And yesterday, actually, I was just, I didn't even think about that, but the very automatically, I mean, we're supposed to be doing contemplation, Buddha and Dhamma, but I was just sitting here and I started to think about the generosity of my parents and the things I've learned from my parents. Generosity is one thing which I've learned from my parents. So it's very natural for me to be a monk, put a lot of effort into helping the community, and it comes from my parents. So, and I was contemplating, it just came to my mind very automatically. And it's really, really, it was really uplifting. It was like one of these things. I was just, wow, I learned this from my parents, generosity. And it's so a lot of those things you don't think it, or you might think it just benefits you, but if you keep your sila, if you have goodness in your heart, your virtue, or if you're a generous person, you're helping others, however you see that jaga, generosity, it doesn't just change your life, it changes lives around you. People see you as a moral, generous person, somebody who has a mind which is leaning towards letting go. So those are the things we should be looking at, cultivating, just uplifting ourselves. I've done so many good things. It's too easy to fall into the rut of seeing the bad qualities in you. Don't worry, you should not worry too much about those bad qualities or unwholesome qualities, however you want to look at it. Instead, we should try to concentrate on the goodness and uplift our mind a little bit. It's really important to see the goodness in ourselves. There is not enough praise in this world. We don't get enough from others. Not enough, unfortunately. The world doesn't uplift ourselves, uplift our minds enough. And if anything, we should be generous of giving compliments to others more and more. But so that's why we try to, it's almost like we're complimenting ourselves. So it was really, in that sense, it was really nice for me to do that retreat and really put effort into looking what it feels to be having this kind of uplifted mind. And I've heard people who had a good time yesterday. I certainly did. So it was a nice retreat. The sixth one, again, it's difficult. The Buddha gave the Devanusati. I don't have the cultural feeling for that. It's hard for me to appreciate the celestial beings or, you know, contemplate them in the sense that it uplifts my mind. I just don't have that feeling base. If you grew up with that, it was in your mind for a long time. It is something what uplifts your mind, but I don't have it. So it would be difficult for me to teach it even. And the same thing, but once you cultivate these things, once you cultivate, you're seeing the goodness of your, what, you know, I've been a good person. You're seeing generosity, whether it's in you or you're seeing, you know, you learn generosity from somebody, it grows bigger. It's almost like a memory. And actually, in that word, anusati, the last part of it, it's the sati. And sati is almost like a memory. It's something you remember. But the anusati in front of it makes it sort of makes it contemplation, make it something you refine that memory, you dwell on it, you make more of it. So quite often people tell us when, you know, I'm in Finland, I'm in Singapore, I'm in here, I cannot meditate. My mind is too busy. How to meditate? Look, we need to do the groundwork more and more, more often. The groundwork has to be there, that the foundation is there for you to able to let the mind just to disappear. If you work on that foundation, you do good things and then you think about it. It's like, yeah, I've done something nice. I did put the effort in. Or you see it in others. And that almost comes to like, my name is Mudita. You're seeing the goodness in others and that uplifts your mind. I've seen the goodness in my parents. I see the generosity. They taught me the generosity just by the actions. Not, you know, telling, be generous. By the actions, I see those good things. And it really is something what makes you cry when you start thinking about it. And that's the feeling. And in Buddhism, we have a lot of technical teachings and they are very interesting. And you can dwell on those and look at things almost scientifically. And it's really interesting when you get, you know, into those nitty gritty things. But a lot of these things should be actually when you're growing in a path in this going further and further, it should be more and more feeling based. It should be more and more, I feel good. And the feeling of the goodness is something which is quietness of the mind. So that's it. We are all, this is aiming for that. It's making the groundwork, giving you the foundation. And then you keep coming here, you keep refining that gold, and eventually it does work. Slowly, slowly, when you keep at it, there's no other way, it will work. If you keep looking at yourself like I'm worth of, like anybody else, I'm worth of same amount of gold than everybody else. Not anything better, not anything worse. But the, you know, the refinement has to happen. Perhaps you don't have it yet. And then those technical things, they do work as well. Because you look the same way. Anusati is a wrong way of using this word, but you can same way when you see the Dhamma, you analyze it. You look at from the different angle. You start feeling what the Buddha was teaching. And then obviously the big breakthroughs happen when you have deep meditation, then you are separated from yourself. But then again, it's almost like a feeling based. It really is a big, like a wow factor. Like, wow, what happened? It's not this kind of normal way of thinking, analyzing, what does non-self mean? Or what does anicca, impermanence, unreliable, what does it really mean? It keeps us in there, gives us that kind of like, yeah, it's interesting. I can see that's how the world works. Everything is impermanent. Nothing is reliable, anicca. We teach anatta. You look everywhere, you look into, like, I cannot see my body itself. I cannot see a point in my body. This belongs to me. This is who I am. This is what makes me. Or even if you start looking at your mind, what's how its mind is made. You can see the anatta, the non-self there. You see the emptiness in all of these phenomena, however you want to look. It's interesting, but it doesn't have that kind of wow factor. Just the best thing I could perhaps describe, which is you can relate to that. And yesterday I went through that. It's when you start meditating and you are disappearing more and more. And that gives you the feedback. That disappeared. And because of that disappearance, you understand I still existed, so I'm not that thing. Until then, you're so immersed into that thing. And the best thing, the easiest way for what I think I can explain it, it's almost like when your body starts disappearing. And why I say it starts disappearing, because it disappears, it doesn't just all of a sudden vanish and it's not there. We are always have this image in our mind's eye of body. We always feel the body. It's almost like a mind-made body. And that's why they say even after death, we make our bodies with the mind. So we have a mind-made body after you die. That goes a little bit too much into, perhaps for some, for into religion, but there's a mind-made body because we associate ourselves with our body. We cannot be anything outside of our body most of the time. We know what even our toes look like. If somebody puts, you know, a set of, you know, their foot next to it and you put a canvas over it and you're just like, no, no, those are not my toes. Those are my toes. You know what your toes look like. You have this image of your body. And the same, so the same way what happens is when you start, your body starts disappearing and it perhaps even disappears completely, it is very exciting. It's not like, oh, the body is just disappearing, nothing to worry about. It's almost like a dying moment. It's just weird experience when the body starts disappearing. It's absolutely, it's just sort of like, it's just, you cannot help but to wonder, be at awe of something. It's just, it blows your mind. It's just something you never knew you can be without your body. You always have, like I said, you always have an image of your body. You, even if you close your eyes, you know the limits of your body, know what the body feels like. But at this point, when the body starts disappearing, and you look in your mind's eye, you put your attention to your body, you don't see anything. The image is not there. There's no feeling there in the body. Just all this, the sense spaces of that part of the body have disappeared. There's no heat, there's no cold, there's no pain, there is no body there. It's almost like you're looking into a void, or you're looking into, what could simile could I give? Something which just like you're supposed to be seeing something, but there's nothing there. It's just so weird. And so these things, there's a lot of very, very exciting things what happens when the meditation starts happening. So in that sense, I'm not completely sure why I went to this. I'm supposed to talk about the anusati, the contemplation, but see, okay, we moved into the meditation part now. But all of these things, they give you feedback. I can exist without body. So perhaps that was the, you know, okay, that's sati. So that it's a sati, it's like a memory. It's a more like a awareness or feedback, however you want to see it. It's exciting. It's something which raises your hair. It gives you, you look at it differently. I can be separated from my body, and it's a weird experience. Until then, you don't know how to be anything except your body, or with your body, rather. When you die, you're separated from automatically, but you can do that before you die. And it's the same thing with your mind things. All these things, your mind starts shutting down, and you, obviously, you go to nimitta or you go to jhanas, you are just, there's just an object. There is no you and object. The separation is not, there is no anything except the object. So how can you exist when there's just an object, object being depending how refined it is, but it's just like in the beginning, it's just a joy, for example. How can there be just be joy and nothing else? Where is you then? These are now, I'm talking about jhanas now. I'm going into the jhana stages. But I mean, just so you can imagine, if the body disappears and you exist, well, that gives you automatically the feedback, I'm not my body. It's not an intellectual pursuit. It's a feeling-based. It's something you know. It's a little bit the same with these contemplations. It's not intellectual. It might be in the beginning. You trust others that I should be doing this. You trust that it's good to contemplate the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Jaga, Sila, Deva. It's good to do that. You might just come more intellectually into that. I should be doing that. It makes sense. It uplifts my mind. But you need to develop it into a feeling or where it sort of makes you cry. It raises the hair in the back of your head. It really uplifts your mind. In that sense, then you know that anusati, that contemplation is working. When it makes you cry out of happiness, out of, wow, I've learned something amazing from, like I said, from my parents, their generosity. I had to learn it from somewhere. And it's an amazing thing. So keep refining your mind in that sense. You're making the foundation more and more solid. It's always with you, the foundation. And then you build up that meditation on it. And then from there, your faith grows, your confidence rather, however you want to look at it. Your understanding grows from that. We should be growing in wisdom, and the wisdom grows from all these experiences. The wisdom is part of that kind of feeling factor. There is nothing separate from that those feelings. That is wisdom. And you really to be a wise person is somebody, a wise person is somebody who has have a lot of calmness in their mind. They're not whisked around with this worldly praise and blame. They're not whisked around the external conditions. They understand they are free, they are their own island. To be sort of the master of your own universe, or perhaps that's a bit too poetic, but to be independent from the world in a sense. Obviously, we are all connected with each other, but to be independent, truly independent of the world, where you're not like a little thing just bobbing up and down on this big sea. You have to have a solid foundation. The world is always trying to push us here and there, make us do things, put us down, bring us up. But to have the solid foundation is you need to keep at contemplating goodness of your heart, something which uplifts you. And that comes into one of my favorite suttas. I've probably told them many times here, but I'm sure most of you forget, so I can tell it over and over again. One of my favorite suttas is there's a Mahanama was passing away, and he said he was worried, so he asked Buddha to come and talk to him, and he said, look, I'm worried. I'm not the stream mentor yet. What's going to happen to me? Will I find the Dhamma again? Which way I'm going to go? You don't know. Once you start looking at it, it's actually quite scary. You never know whether you're going to find what we have here again when you pass away, until you're a stream mentor. The Buddha said, don't worry, Mahanama. If you have the confidence into the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, the respect, confidence, I think the word they use there is respect more, but I like that idea that you contemplate it, then a lot of them make a lot of those three things, the Buddha, the teacher, the Dhamma, the teachings, and the Sangha. You contemplated them over and over again. And you have your Sila. Again, the Sila comes there. The same things Buddha taught many, many places. Sila is the fourth. So you have three things, which is your contemplate. Well, again, actually the Sila is, I didn't even think of that. The Sila is also your contemplation. So you have these four things supporting you. You have the respect towards the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and your sila. And if you have those four things, the Buddha said it's almost like it's like a tree. If there's a tree which is leaning towards, I always forget whether it's east or west, but let's say it's west because the sun sets. It's like a tree which is leaning towards. No, let's take east. I like east. The tree which is leaning towards east. And if a four strong men come, and I've been trying to figure out what are the strong four strong men. Is there some underlying meaning for in this sutta? I haven't yet figured this out. I should ask the more senior teachers, old teachers who can maybe make it up. I don't know if there's any meaning for that. Four strong men come and they cut down the tree which is leaning to east. They cut it down from the root. Which way is it going to fall? Is it going to fall north, south, west, or east? And the Mahanama said, of course, it's going to fall towards east. And the Buddha said the same way. If you have those four things, you have the respect towards Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and your sila as your fourth, you're always leaning towards Nibbana, always leaning towards finding the Dhamma. And I find it really, really nice sutta. It's very inspiring. So even if you don't get there, as long as you're leaning towards that, your lean is always there. And when it comes crashing down, you will always crashing down that direction till you find it. So in that sense, who knows where you're going to crash down and where you're going to actually the new sapling takes a root. Somebody told me that they go to this website. I think there's Buddhist jokes or Buddhist humor website. And there's apparently one of them was a cartoon where it says there's in a cartoon, there's a tombstone, and it says in a tombstone, see you soon. See you later soon. So I thought it was a really nice cartoon. It's like, okay, see you soon. It's just how it is. The new sapling takes a root when the craving starts again. And you don't know really where it starts growing. You might end up like me in northern part of Finland, and you know, it's a bit. So it might take you a while to get across to find the Dhamma, but once you find it, it's you cannot stop but going towards it. It's same for me. One of the teachings, early teachings, got me in this. Into the Dhamma. I was living in New York and I was trying to start meditating and looking really into it. And one of the early things which really caught my, I realized that I had really massive pull towards that. There was one of my teachers was teaching about anicca, impermanence or unreliability. And he said, can you see anywhere in this world which is permanent, which is always there, which is never changing? Whether it's in your body or your mind, outside world, anywhere in this universe, can you see anything which is always reliably there, which is never changing? And I was thinking, wow, these are the Buddhist teachings? That's amazing. And all these things, when you start looking at them differently, contemplate, that's Dhamma contemplation then. It's like, wow, it makes sense. I'm not in charge. My mind is changing all the time. And then you start looking, oh, that's what it means by seeing the anatta, non-self. How can there be a self when everything is constantly changing? Constantly. It's difficult sometimes to see how your mind changes all the time, but when you start meditating, it gives you the feedback. And then all these things, they start intermingling, and it's the wisdom grows from that. It's almost like a little insights, and it uplifts your mind. So even those insights you have, dwell on them, make more of them. What inspired you to get into Buddhism? What is the starting factor? Or what were those like wow moments? Make more of them. Think about them in your mind, and it becomes bigger. And so it's a really nice thing where we keep at it, and it grows in us. And then, okay, perhaps when the tree goes crashing down, you don't have that You're not an island yet. You're not the island means you're not a stream enter yet. You're not a solid entity yet by yourself. You don't stand on the solid ground yet. But at least you are leaning towards that. At least you're always leaning towards peace. So it's a comforting idea that I'm doing something right. At least I have something which gives me meaning in life. And I totally understand in many other religions, they have the same thing. Faith, it brings a lot of joy in people because you have something you can rely on. But in this one, in Buddhism, we can't really rely on others to help us too much. In that sense, there's like an entity outside of us. We are in charge of our own happiness, our own salvation, our own... we have to rely on ourselves. We have to rely that our minds are nothing outside of these influences or from outside. It's only how we relate to that mind, those influences. There's not much we can do about anything, really. Ajahn Pramali was here. Before I went to Finland, a lot of you were perhaps on his retreat. It was a really nice, the Sutta retreat Ajahn Pramali was doing here. When was it? Like a month and a half ago? 2 months ago now? And somebody asked him about the free will, and he gave a really brilliant answer. And actually, I went back to it, and I was teaching in Finland, so I translated that in Finnish, and I thought it was such a nice answer. And he said, free will... it's a really almost like a moot concept. It's almost like it's something which is doesn't make sense really to look at it in Buddhism. It's a concept which is, do we have free will or not? It's a tricky one. We cannot say no and we cannot really say yes. It's neither one of those things. It's almost like you have a little bit of wiggle room there. I'm completely botching his answer now, but it's all the causes and conditions from the past come to you in this moment. And determined from those things, we have sort of free will to choose, but only from those causes. So that in Buddhism we would use, that would be your karma, everything, all the other influences. Yeah, come into this moment, and then you can have this like a little thing. I can choose from those things. So the how much you can actually choose is very, very limited. We do this. We have this kind of. We think we have a free will. We can choose, but the limitations are from the past, and they're very, very. Once you start seeing how limited you are. He gave a simile like, okay, we're going to have a lunchtime soon. You can choose between the food you take or not. But you're still sort of like, there's still a lot of like a guesstimation, guesswork. Do I like that? Don't I like that? That could be cold. That would be too spicy. Maybe that's not good for my stomach. You have this kind of little wiggle room there. But really what really matters about this free will or choices is, when you do anusati, contemplation, when you study Dhamma, when you have mind which is uplifted, then you make choices based on that. Based on mind which is uplifted, based on something which is the goodness of your heart. If you contemplate sila, if you contemplate generosity, that moment, you're making choices from that condition. So that is a good condition to make choices from. So then your choices will be better. The free will is there, but that's your factor where it comes from. So I don't know how differently I can put this. Ajahn Pramali used in that simile, you know, you did a sutta retreat and he said, you know, now because I'm based on conditioning, this was the conditioning, you know, reading suttas, looking at them, uplifting your mind from that. The conditions are there now. At that point, they would like you were, he was reading suttas, and from based on that, you make choices. So your choices are then conditioned by that. So we have to try to condition our mind certain way. And so by contemplation, by looking at it from different angles, by feeling these things, you're changing the conditioning. And from the condition, what comes after that, your choices. You always have to make choices no matter what, and it's constantly happening. That changes your choices. Is there free will? Again, I mean, it's a moot point. It's those conditions. It's only what's affecting your mind. But if the conditions are good, the choices end up being good. There was an interesting question in Singapore. Somebody asked, can we manifest something? I can't remember what they manifest something. And I thought it was a really strange question, so I thought it was fun. So can we manifest the universe, or can we manifest things? And I was like, what kind of question is this? And then somebody like, oh, yeah, no, there's this idea that, you know, like if you ask something from the universe, or you contemplate, you manifest it, it's going to come to you. So I don't know what this person is trying to manifest, maybe a winning a lottery or something. You keep asking. And that's the thing, I think, what we most of the time we're asking. I wish I could get a loving partner. I wish I would get a lot of money, and then I didn't have to do anything. I'm sure those are the manifestations a lot of us have. Or I wish I was healthier. I wish somebody around me was healthier. There's these kind of things we're trying to manifest. I don't think there's a lot of things you can manifest. You cannot manifest your own health. You cannot manifest, perhaps, I don't know, winning a lottery. You can try. I'm sure a lot of people do. One thing you can, and I was like, okay, yeah, manifesting, asking from universe. Okay, you are manifesting your future by how you look at this moment. So whatever you decide here will become the future. So if you're manifesting kindness in your mind, what are you manifesting in the future? You're manifesting in kindness in the future. If you're manifesting greed, what are you manifesting in the future? You will get greed from that. So it does work. So if you want to have greed a future that you won't be satisfied, manifest greed in this moment. You're not satisfied, and you keep getting more and more unsatisfaction in the future. So sure, whatever you manifest, that will come. And in that sense, we always teach, okay, manifest contentment, manifest kindness. And now we looked into, you know, Buddhanusati, Dhammanusati, Sanghanusati, manifest having respect towards the teacher, the teachings, and the Sangha who came after that, who kept the teachings alive. Somebody you can respect here and now. And you keep manifesting, I've done good, I've been a good person, make more of it. Don't think it's nothing. I've given donation, I've given time, I've served, I helped others. You keep looking at it, don't think it's nothing. Don't say it's okay, it's nothing. It is something, it's a big thing. Say always when people say, thank you for doing that, say, you know, you're welcome. Don't say it's nothing. It's all right. Say, yes, it's a, you know, you don't have to say, yeah, I'm good. But it's like, yeah, that's okay. And keep dwelling on it. And then you're manifesting more generosity in your mind. Your mind inclines towards that. You're making choices, but your choices are now going towards, I'm a generous person. You're looking at sila, you're manifesting more virtue, manifesting more kindness in the future. I'm a good person. You're making choices from coming from a place, I'm a good person. And that's how you choose. That's how you condition, that's how you change the conditioning. And that's how you become. So do that. Keep at it, and if you keep at it, I cannot see it not working. And if you keep saying that the meditation doesn't work, well, the foundation is you haven't worked enough on that. It's not the meditation doesn't work because you didn't sit enough hours. You didn't contemplate enough hours that you're how good you are. You didn't contemplate enough of that. So that's the work we have to do on everyday life. And I think that's the talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Arjan, for the talk.
Mm-hmm.
Any question from the floor?
You're welcome.
Is it on? I was going to ask a question about manifesting.
Mm-hmm.
Only because it's a real thing and it comes up a lot.
Apparently,
it seems to be. Yeah. And it seems like really at odds with what we're trying to do here and, you know, practicing Buddhism. Because.
Yeah.
My question was if, because you can get, what it is, it's really like thinking clearly about a specific thing.
Right.
And believing that you already have it, which implies that you can control the universe like a wizard and
yeah.
then manipulate it and you will get, but an actual thing. So, but then when you were talking about, I think that's a good way of thinking about it, about the feelings and, you know. Like meditating on like that, which isn't what manifestation is, like the package people are selling. But
yeah,
I just wondered how it kind of seeps into.
Well, how it seeps into. Well, the thing is, if you're trying to manifest, Ferrari, and you have a lot of greed towards that, but when you get it, the problem is you had that lot of that greed, and then it's not satisfying. You get something nice. But then it's sort of, in the beginning, exciting, and you know, like, wow, is it like you take pictures and show others? And it's like, yeah, it's really nice. But after a while, that the wow factor really dissipates because of you manifested, what you actually manifest is greed, non-contentment. So if you manifest like a contentment and like I'm just happy what I have and Ferrari comes to your way, then you're more content with it. You're not always looking for, after a while, it's like, oh, I wish I could get a new one now. Or, you know, the greed is never satisfied. So if that's what you're manifesting, and, you know, if you get the physical thing, it's not satisfied. It doesn't really change the itch. The itch is still there because you didn't work on that underlying condition so much. So, you know, manifest things, but yeah, manifest on, like, I'm content. And then things come to your way and you're content with them as well. So, I don't know. I guess there's a lot of interesting ideas, and I've been asked now a couple of times. And
there was a book that got very popular.
Right.
That people were buying.
Right, that was the book. Okay, maybe I read the book.
Yeah. No, it's called The Law of Attraction.
Law of Attraction, yeah. I mean, okay, I can see that there's a lot of, it's like a Law of Attraction. I'm sure it comes a lot of like finding your soulmate and those kind of things. I'm sure it's things, very, very human things. Like a lot of people have this desire to have somebody like partner, soulmate, or whatever. I'm sure it comes into that kind of thing. So how do I manifest that kind of person? So you, yeah. I would still say, as if you try to manifest that contentment and kindness and all that, and whatever partner comes to your way, you're more content with that, because otherwise, in a few years' time, it's not such an amazing partner after all. So there's no satisfying the whimsical things in the life. Yeah. It is interesting. Anything else?
Yeah. I think it's been more helpful for me to think about like how out of control things are, instead of, because the manifest, that idea of like, if you just put the frequencies out strong enough, that's just feels like trying to get more and more and more and more control over your life. And when you don't get the things that happen, then that's when more suffering will happen. So,
yeah, I could see that. I kind of really see, it's hard to see that it brings happiness, joy in your mind. It does bring this kind of like, I'm missing out. So you all the time, you just, that's what you're actually manifesting.
And then when you don't, it means you failed to project the frequencies.
That's a wrong frequency. That's it. Well, I would say really good frequency is to have kindness. That would be a really good frequency. So to try to manifest that frequency, just to, you know, and hopefully some others can tune into it, but we cannot really control the world too much. Good question, yeah, or comment. There's, yeah, we can take it online, then we can come back.
Okay. Yeah, this online question. Once when I was very sad and thinking that only they were suffering in the world.
There was only suffering in the world, right?
I remember there was people doing goodness in the world, and by realizing that, my breath become beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the anusati or other anusati?
Yeah, you're right. So you contemplate on the goodness of others. Yeah, I would say, I mean, it doesn't really give instructions on, let's say, on sila anusati. The Buddha, there is no clear instructions there. There's no like, this is how you do it. We don't have a manual for that. Perhaps there's later commentaries which explain them more. But, you know, so the Buddha gave these things that we have, as far as I understand, for the sila, for the kindness of others. We don't have a good, we have recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, but not so much for the others. But I would say that is contemplating on the goodness of others. And that's the thing, we have these, it's very easy to see the world, the problems in the world, but it's 50-50. I mean, look, you can look into, you see the goodness, the kindness in others as well, and I think that's what we should try to cultivate, develop more. I really don't know why it's so easy to fall into that abyss of feeling, you know, bad news sells and see the not so good, you know, the greatness of the world, and then everything could be quite dark. It's very easy to fall into it, but so we need to start from our own heart, you know, develop that. So yes, I would say that yes, that would be if you all of a sudden you felt desperate in life, and you see the wars, you see the hunger, you see climate change. There's a lot of things we can be quite. It's quite concerning. It's very, very. What's the word? Confronting and confronting however you feel, your anxiety, it brings anxiety on people, climate change, or many things, even plastic pollution. You look at it and it's like, oh my god, it's not good what's happening. But so you just have to realize that we live in this time, and the world is what it is, and we can only cultivate our minds. There's not much we can how we can control the life outside of ourselves. Do the best of your ability and keep leaning towards the Nibbana.
Thank you, Ajahn.
You want to? Adrian, there's somebody behind you there. Did you want to? Adrian? Oh, yeah, okay. Somebody else got.
Thank you, Ajahn Mudito.
You're welcome.
Just have a quick question about regarding, you said when we develop our sila, goodness in ourselves, to lean towards Nibbana. So I was thinking how to go from that when you're trying to develop the goodness in yourself, loving kindness and, you know, everything, to like letting go and non-self. Like that is like you're developing this goodness, and then how to lead to non-self. That's the progression that I'm
the progression to non-self, okay, to when you're doing these things. It actually leads towards it quite very naturally. So you kind of have a strong self, idea of strong self, or the idea or the feeling of self when you have kindness in your mind. It's actually the, it's the opposite. When, and all of these things, they replace that idea of this is who I am. It's you kind of really own those things when it, when the contemplation is done correctly. It's hard to own a feeling of kindness. Like, you, even when you make it more of it, it's like, I'm a good person. I've done good things. I'm generous. However, whatever the contemplation you do, or if you do the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, it's almost like an object outside of yourself anyway. So how do you, you cannot own, when you make more of it, you contemplate the, it diminishes that strong sense of self. If you give, and the giving is, may I receive something from this, may I get born into good rebirth, may I, then you, the contemplation, it's wrong way of doing the contemplation. So obviously there is right way and wrong way. I don't want to really say wrong way, but the, it's tinted, it's tainted a little bit. So if you say, you know, if I give this, may I receive something back, then that contemplation is, it's not, if it's not combined with your sila, that's what it comes from the suttas, it doesn't lead you towards that, actually, that destination. So if you think you can give and buy something for yourself in this spiritual path, you have to have a little bit of more wisdom. You have to sort of get back to your senses. Oh, I'm doing something which is, this is not how you contemplate. So, but I kind of really see people actively doing, at least if they're reminded, like, no, you just give and just let it go. Otherwise, so we're not trying to get things to ourselves, really. It's all really, the self does disappear there. And it's replaced by feelings of kindness and generosity and your goodness, sila, or virtue. You kind of really own your virtue. If you become a virtuous person, it's very difficult to see that you become a person which is sort of going around saying, like, oh, I'm such a virtuous person. I'm the most humble, most humblest person. It doesn't work that way. So I don't think there is a danger there, really, if you keep at it. Yeah, I would not say that. Adrian, there's one lady. Do you want to give the microphone here? But yeah, good question. That microphone, the volume is low on that one, I think, but mine is always really low. But keep it really close to your mouth. And
okay, it's just...
Yeah, it works.
Yeah. Just to expand on the manifestation discussion, I think it's, in defense of this, it's about mind state. So certain mind states will create illness, and if you have a very
right
hard mind or fear...
Yeah.
And so then... I know a story about a woman called Anita Mojani, and she died of cancer.
Or almost died, yeah.
Almost died, yeah. Yes. But she had a near-death experience, and yeah, she realized how guilt and fear had contributed to her illness.
Yeah.
And so it was her mind.
Oh, that's right. She had a near-death experience. I actually called the same doctor who treated her.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What a coincidence, yes. Yeah. So I think in terms of looking at manifestation through that lens, that it's about mind states, so that if we look at how fear impacts our physical health and
that's a good
like
point.
That, yes.
Mm, good way of looking at it.
Okay.
Thank Negative you. Mind states, you manifest, and I was sort of alluding to it, and you looked at it differently. Exactly right. That if you have the fear inside of anxiety, and that's what you're manifesting. You're manifesting sicknesses in your body, and that's a really nice thing. Actually, what I've noticed that when you're calm and you allow the body just to relax, you can see it feels healthy. It really has this kind of feeling of like, my body just feels a lot healthier when I can relax. quite often we don't notice how tired we are of, you know, tension, and anxiety has places in your body, it's stomach or shoulders or somewhere, and we manifest in cancer.
Yes.
Perhaps we're doing that, yeah.
Yes. Well, that's Joe Dispenza talks a lot about that, about, and he can actually, through meditation techniques, help people to reverse illnesses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's a good way of looking at manifestation, actually, yes. That's true. One in the back, and okay. Adrian, can you take the microphone in the back? I'll try to answer quickly, and then we go instead of... So ask short question, I'll give short answers.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. I had a question to elaborate on an earlier question that you answered around how can you delineate the line where you, like if you're thinking I'm doing good things, I'm a good person, like yeah. whilst you're meditating, how does that then, how do you find a delineation to not have an inflated sense of ego? And then start kind of, I know you won't walk around starting to tell everyone like I'm a virtuous person, but surely like you kind of, you have this sense of like, you know, ego, like the ego builds up over time. So how do you find that?
Yeah, don't worry about it. Yeah, okay. No, it won't happen. No, don't. Yeah. Next question. No, it's not not an issue.
Any other
good question, but it's not, make a big head by being kind. That's okay. And if you have problem, come to us in a few years' time, but I don't think it's going to become an issue. Yep, next question.
Is there...
It does work. It's quiet, but yeah, it does work, yeah.
Okay.
Just keep it really close to your mouth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there like a framework for the things you're supposed to contemplate? Because I've been doing a lot of meditation, but maybe progress is a little slow, and I'm interested in learning contemplation, but... it'd be nice if there was like a book I could read or...
Right. Okay, so is there a book you could... it would be nice if you have the actual guidelines. Not that I can think of now. I did do some study. This microphone is now super loud, so I think you turn this up. I can show you a little... If you come to the Dana time now, I can show you the book I was reading. But look, there is contemplations. What we chanted actually when we were doing here. We have the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Nusati, Anusati. So you contemplate the qualities of the Buddha. You contemplate what the Dhamma is. So there is those key words are there. So you can keep looking at it. So that's a very very narrow guideline. But like I say, I like the idea, like Ajahn Brahm says, you look at it from different angles. Whatever, you know, like, oh, that's really nice. I can feel that. So whatever that feeling comes to you, so you just look in like almost like a scientific way of like, I look at it differently. I just like, this is what makes me happy. Like, I can see this working. I can see the Dhamma in this way. Like, oh, that's really uplifting. So in that sense, you have to... There's no really rigid guidelines, and this is how it's going to work for you. It's a feeling. So what makes you feel inspired? We cannot just say this, what makes you inspired? No, you're inspired. No, I'm not. Well, there's no rigid guidelines. Yeah. So you just keep at it, keep looking at it, and, you know, looking different angles, keep practicing, and the inspiration grows from that, actually. Yeah. The one more question behind you, Adrian. No. Okay, so that's it. Time for Dana. Thank you for everybody. It's nice to see everybody. Sugiyo, sadasu.